From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. It's been many years since poet Philip Levine worked in the factories of Detroit, but the memories of sweat and fire have stayed with him. Now he writes poems about what work is. On this Labor Day, Levine reads from his collection of poems and talks with us about work and poetry. Also, we talk with John Cullum. As Holling Vincour on the TV series Northern Exposure, he plays a 63-year-old tavern owner in love with an 18-year-old beauty queen. And rock critic Ken Tucker plays his two favorite summer hits. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Corey Flintoff. The presidential contenders kicked off their fall campaigns today trying to win voters in some key Midwestern states. Democrat Bill Clinton went to Independence, Missouri to challenge President Bush's effort to compare himself with former President Harry Truman. Clinton charged that the president had used the issue of race to divide the country while Truman had encouraged civil rights laws. He said that Truman had fostered the growth of the middle class, and he accused George Bush of trying to destroy it. As Clinton campaigned in former President Truman's hometown, President Bush contrasted the two Democrats at a GOP picnic in Milwaukee, Wisconsin. NPR's Elizabeth Arnold reports.
President Bush has frequently likened himself to the Democrat who came from behind to win re-election in 1948. Today, however, with Clinton campaigning in Truman's hometown, Mr. Bush told a crowd of Wisconsin Republicans Clinton is nothing like Truman. Truman came from the private sector and ran as an underdog against the do-nothing Congress, he said. And he used the former president to raise the issue of Clinton's draft status, saying Truman prided himself on his military service and wanted to fight for his country. So did I, Mr. Bush added. Truman never engaged in doublespeak, Mr. Bush said, as he accused Clinton of waffling on the issue of U.S. military involvement in the Persian Gulf. He hedges and ducks on every tough issue, Mr. Bush said, and he can't have it both ways if he wants to be president. As for himself, Mr. Bush said he plans to campaign and win like Harry Truman, but he admitted he voted for Truman's opponent, Thomas Dewey. I'm Elizabeth Arnold in Hamtramck.
Just over 100,000 homes and businesses are still without electricity in South Florida, 2 weeks after Hurricane Andrew struck. But as NPR's David Malpas reports, the power company is taking some temporary measures.
The Florida Power and Light Company announced today that it will make power available on a temporary basis to homes that are too damaged to be rebuilt. Reconnecting electricity to homes that are unfit to occupy normally isn't done, but the power company has decided to make exceptions in these extraordinary circumstances. A simple pole will be installed with an outlet box attached to provide electricity for lights, home appliances, and power tools. It's estimated that 60,000 to 80,000 residents will be interested in the makeshift hookup. Nearly 75% of customers in the hardest hit areas, Homestead and Florida City, are without power as of now. And officials say it will be another 2 months before they finish the job. I'm David Malpas in Miami.
Doctors in Pittsburgh said today that they're not sure what caused the death of a man who was the world's first recipient of an animal-to-human liver transplant. The 35-year-old man, who'd asked that his name not be made public, died yesterday after surviving for 71 days with a baboon's liver. Doctors said that autopsy results are not yet complete, but the man died after contracting a blood infection. This is NPR News. Today is Brazilian Independence Day, and thousands of demonstrators used the occasion to call for the resignation of President Fernando Collor. The protests broke out at a military parade today in Brasilia, the capital city. Opposition leaders said the demonstrations were spontaneous. They had been planning to hold huge anti-government rallies today, but said they dropped those plans out of fear that they might lose the support of military leaders. The military is reported to be in secret support of the movement to oust Collor. Collor is accused of profiting from a massive influence peddling scheme run by his former campaign treasurer. The president of the former Soviet Republic of Tajikistan reportedly resigned today. NPR's Mike Schuster reports from Moscow.
Both the official Russian news agency Itar Tass and the independent agency Interfax are reporting that Tajikistan's president Rahmon Nabiyev signed a letter today making his resignation official. The resignation appears to have been made under pressure from armed militants opposed to Nabiyev's rule. for a week, Nabiyev had been in hiding in Dushanbe, the capital of Tajikistan, as political turmoil, sometimes violent, had swept the capital and at least one other city. Only today did Nabiyev finally appear in public, apparently in an attempt to fly to northern Tajikistan, where he retains many supporters. But opponents seized him at the airport in Dushanbe, reportedly after some shots were fired. It was only then that Nabiyev decided to resign. He was seen being driven away accompanied by local troops. Sporadic shooting was reported in Dushanbe today. Perhaps as many as 100 or more people have been killed in political violence in a city south of the capital. I'm Mike Schuster in Moscow.
Three former hostages held in Lebanon called today for peace in Northern Ireland, with peace talks that would include the outlawed groups that have been waging the terrorist war there. The former hostages were Americans Terry Anderson and the Reverend Lawrence Jenko and Terry Wade of Britain. They appeared today in Londonderry at a conference called Beyond Hate. I'm Corey Flintoff, NPR News.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. On this Labor Day, poems about work. A review in the New York Times described my guest, poet Philip Levine, as a large, ironic Whitman of the industrial heartland, loyal to his roots in Detroit, determined to remember the exhausted and enraged worker, the unlucky immigrant, the man who gasps for breath and asks, "Am I going to make it?" Philip Levine worked in many factories in Detroit as a young man. Now work means writing poems and teaching at Fresno State College. But the sweat and fire of factory work continue to be the subject of some of his most compelling poems. His latest collection of poems is called What Work Is. It won a 1991 National Book Award. I spoke with Philip Levine after the publication of What Work Is and asked him why work has been such an important theme in his poems.
I suppose because most of my poetry originates in memory. Coleridge said that really the only thing the imagination has to work on is remembered experience. And I find this is very true in my own case. Also, my working days went from age 14, that kind of work, heavy manual labor, from age 14 to about 29. And it seems to me that I was more sensitive to the world around me. I was a learner. I was somebody with his eyes open, constantly looking for teachers. And I think as a youngster growing up in these circumstances, I was just more open to sensation, more open it's an odd word, but almost an exotic world. It was the work of automobile assembly factories, and that it's a very exotic place, or it was when I was very young. There was fire, there was noise, it was like bedlam. Sometimes I remember going into a foundry once to get a job, and I was about 17. They wouldn't hire me. I was too young, and thinking, really, I'm in hell.
Yeah,
this is
uh-huh.
like hell. You know, it was so hot, and it was this liquid metal, and I was terrified. I was glad they wouldn't hire me.
I want you to read the title poem from your new collection, What Work Is. And is there a story you'd like us to hear about the poem before we hear the poem itself?
Yeah, there is. There's a curious story. I never worked at Ford Highland Park, which I mentioned in the poem, but I went there once for a job during a period in the early 50s in Detroit when there was a slight recession, so a lot of people got laid off, although Detroit was a booming town back then. And I waited in line, and it was raining, and it was a long wait. You know, the newspaper would advertise, you know, assemblers. That's the lowest job you can get. And they would put hours down, like 8 to 5. But you knew you had to be there early if you were going to get a job. And so you got there maybe 7:30. Well, they didn't open the employment office till, say, 9. So you stood there for an hour and a half before anything even opened, and there were 50 people ahead of you. But that was in a way to, you know, they wanted to test you. You know, how much crap could you take? Were you willing to wait in line that long? If you weren't, they didn't want you. And so I, as I waited, I grew angrier and angrier at myself. for being this humble character. And finally, maybe about 10:30 or so, I got up to the head of the line. And there was a guy sitting down. I was standing. We each went to a different desk. We stood, they sat. And he said, "What kind of job would you like?" And I don't know where this impulse came from, but I said, "I want your job."
Oh, gee.
And he said, "Okay, take off." And that was it. But I was sort of happy that there was this thing in me that was still there that, you know, said, you know, "I don't want you and you don't want me." And so I suppose that I never forgot that moment of standing there all that time and then being, you know, a smart mouth.
Did you have the money to afford to mouth off like that and lose the pay for the day?
No. No, I didn't. I remember I went to Chevrolet Gear and Axle, which was an awful place, later that day, and got another got a job there, which was just as bad. You know, it was just as bad a place. I was married at the time. I had to make a living. I had responsibilities. So I really couldn't afford to be who I wanted to be. You know? Let me read the poem. What work is? We stand in the rain in a long line, waiting at Ford Highland Park for work. You know what work is. If you're old enough to read this, you know what work is, although you may not do it. Forget you. This is about waiting, shifting from one foot to another, feeling the light rain falling like mist into your hair, blurring your vision, until you think you see your own brother ahead of you, maybe 10 places. You rub your glasses with your fingers, and of course it's someone else's brother, narrower across the shoulders than yours, but with the same sad slouch, the grin that does not hide the stubbornness, the sad refusal to give in to rain, to the hours wasted waiting, to the knowledge that somewhere ahead, a man is waiting who will say, "No, we're not hiring today," for any reason he wants. You love your brother. Now suddenly you can hardly stand the love flooding you for your brother, who's not beside you or behind or ahead, because he's home, trying to sleep off a miserable night shift at Cadillac, so he can get up before noon to study his German. Works 8 hours a night so he can sing Wagner, the opera you hate most, the worst music ever invented. How long has it been since you told him you loved him, held his wide shoulders, opened your eyes wide and said those words, and maybe kissed his cheek? You've never done something so simple, so obvious. Not because you're too young or too dumb. Not because you're jealous or even mean or incapable of crying in the presence of another man. No, just because you don't know what work is.
When did you start writing about your experiences in factories? Were you still in factories when you were writing poems?
I was unable to write any poetry about my working life while that was my working life. I tried a few times, and the poems were hysterical. I think they were just, you know, I couldn't control them. My anger was so overwhelming that I couldn't cope with it. Just as I couldn't write about my boyhood very effectively, until I was, 40. It was still too powerful for me. But I'm patient, so I hung in there, and that's probably my chief virtue as a writer, is my patience. So I waited, and I kept trying to write about factory work, but I kept throwing the poems away. And the first poem I ever published about working in a factory, I was, 31 or 2. But I don't like the poem anymore.
Can you give me a sense of what was going wrong in the factory poems when you were still there? there anything?
Yes, okay. Yes, I can. The language was overblown. I wanted to use the word eternity, and I wanted to use a kind of Latin diction, almost a Miltonic diction, and a great chorus, build up a great chorus of sound, and to dramatize the horror show of some of the places I'd worked. And I didn't have any. There was no tenderness in it for the people that I worked with. There was no, that was part of the reward that I got for those years was the people I was meeting, even though you didn't talk to them that much because the places were often so loud. But you'd meet them afterwards, or you'd make friends with them and spend time with them. And they weren't getting in the poems at all. The poems were, my poor soul being hammered out of shape by General Motors. And they were a bit self-indulgent. Yeah.
A lot of times there's usually like two main reasons why a 14-year-old would work in a factory. One is because he or she or the family needs money. But the other is to be taught the meaning of work by well-meaning parents. So why did you start working in a factory so young?
Well, the jobs were there. It was World War II, and anybody in Detroit could get a job. And I wanted the money. I did it for the money, honey. I remember two young anarchists came to see me once when I was living in San Francisco, and they were enormously disappointed that I hadn't gone into factory work as a young guy to form cadres of the working class.
Yes.
I said to them, I'll tell you the truth, I went to make a living. And, I was discovering the beauty of women, for example. Actually, they were probably girls. I was more interested in women, though they weren't interested in me, naturally. I was 14. I was very short, too. And I thought in order to romance women, the way fellows were doing it in the films I was seeing, I had to have some money in my pocket. I had to have a suit to wear. I had to, if I possible, I could get a car somewhere. And I mean, it was hard to carry on a romance on the, on a Detroit bus or a streetcar. And so these were things that were driving me. I mean, just what drives, 14-year-olds and 15-year-olds all over America today, I suppose. And so I took these jobs and saved my money and got my suits and wasted my money.
Poet Philip Levine is my guest. More after this short break. This is Fresh Air. My guest is poet Philip Levine. His latest collection of poems is called What Work Is. What was your final goodbye to factory work?
My final goodbye was, it came when my first wife left me, which is why I always love the word goodbye. And I didn't have to do this. Also, I wasn't in debt. And it just suddenly occurred to me, she's gone. I don't owe anybody anything. I'm going to quit. I'm going to live on my wits, or try. And so I started to try to live on my wits. And sure enough, I've done it.
So what did
not
that?
Not too well all the time, but
When you decided to live on your wits, where did you go? What did you do for money?
Well, actually, I took a job with my brother. I don't want to describe it, because he'd get mad at me, and for a long summer, and I could live like a little church mouse, and then I went off to the University of Iowa to study poetry writing with Robert Lowell, and I thought there was a fellowship there for me, and when I got there, I was a year late, and the fellowship had been given to somebody else, even though I'd written them and said, hold it for me. And so I never registered. I just took courses without paying for them and kept saying, oh, that information will get to you soon. And I studied with Robert Lowell and then John Berryman. And John Berryman was a great teacher, just a great teacher. And I never needed another teacher after that. So I had a year of studying with two terrific poets and not living particularly well. Then I met my second wife. She wasn't my wife when I met her. She was just a lucky single woman. And we got married, and my wife worked for a while. And when our second child came, I started teaching then. And by this time, I'd published enough poetry to get a job teaching. And I'd finished a master's degree through the mail from Wayne University. So I lucked in there. I got this terrific woman. I mean, she's not just that she supported me. She's also a marvelous woman. I'm still married to her. Thank God. She hasn't abandoned me.
You've written a lot of poems that where your brother figures into the poem.
Yeah.
Do you see your brother as like the alternate version of your life or something? You know, like somebody who you could have been and you're not, or I mean, like what function do you see your brother as serving, almost as metaphor or something within your poems?
Yeah, you know, first thing, I'm an identical twin.
Ah.
And I didn't realize how significant this was in my poetry. I have a great many poems in which men have these encounters with each other, and a couple poems in which they embrace very deeply, they hold each other. And I think that a lot of that, I remember a guy writing, a wonderful man named David Calstone, who's dead now, writing a review of one of my books and talking about these encounters and how powerful they were or how powerful he felt they were. And it was that review that opened my eyes to the fact that, of course, the roots of that are that the terrible wrenching away from my twin brother. I grew up half believing I was half a person. It's very curious to grow up as an identical twin. Not sure that I was the whole person. Maybe I was me and him both, or me, you know, it's very difficult to describe. But I don't think since I was five I've ever felt that anything as close as I'd felt up to that time, maybe six or seven, when we began to drift apart. And I remember when I first started writing poetry, it was enormously, I was about, oh, I don't know. Well, actually, I didn't show my brother the first poems I wrote. I didn't show him poems until I was about 17 or so. And he loved them. He just loved them. And he would take, he's a bigger guy than I, and he's more aggressive physically and in every other way. And he would take these poems and show them to people and say, what do you think? Isn't this great? That's what he would say. Isn't this great? And of course, they'd say, yeah, because he was kind of an intimidating guy. My brother's a great poet. And in some ways, it was the high point of my writing career. I mean, I had one reader, and he was absolutely mad for what I was doing. Now I have many more readers, but I don't know if any of them, you know, are so totally, totally taken with what I write. I was really writing totally for two people, myself and my brother. Since then, I've discovered others but it was quite amazing.
You said that you were wrenched away from your twin brother. When were you wrenched away?
I was afraid you'd ask that. I just felt at a certain point in my life that when I was quite young, that I had to be myself. I began to make discoveries about him, that he wasn't me. There were ways in which he reacted to experiences. I could see that it was they just weren't my reactions. And so a time came when I said, I can't go on with this. I have to find out my own identity and live it. And so I suppose the wrenching was something I imposed upon myself. My guess is he probably felt something similar. I do think there were times when our inmost thoughts were communicated to each other without our speaking. we were that close.
How close are you now?
I'd rather not talk about that.
That's fine, okay. Does he still read your poems?
I don't know. I would hope so.
I want to get back to something you said early in the interview.
Sure.
You said that, then this is when you were, you know, waiting online for factory jobs and knowing that you might get turned down. You said you couldn't afford to be who you wanted to be. And I think within that sentence is a pretty interesting class analysis about identity. You know what I mean? That it takes a certain amount of money in a way to live, not only to live the life you want, but to be who you want to be.
That's right. That's right. I mean, for example, I was politically very conscious. I was aware of exploitation. I remember my brother and I at about age 10 swearing we would never exploit other people. We would never live off the labor of other people, you know, in a way in which they were abused and we were given an advantage on their hard work. And I remember when I worked at for a General Motors factory once, you had to take these IQ tests before you started working. And they said, you know, we'd like to put you into our management program. You've done very well on this IQ test. I lied and said I'd never gone to college or they'd never hire you. And they said, gee, these scores are wonderful. And I said, no. And they said, we would send you to Flint, Michigan. You go to a school there. You know, we have a slavery school there. You know, you'll be taught really how to torture people effectively and subtly. And we'll pay you twice as much, and when you're done, we'll give you a suit and a tie. Wouldn't you like to do that? I said, no, I just like to be a slave myself. I mean, I didn't like being a slave, but I had taken an oath that I wasn't going to exploit people. And my brother was watching me. I couldn't break it. He's a very stubborn guy. And so it was a determination we made. It would be nice to be able to afford it. Of course, then what do you have to do? You have to change the world so that lots of people can take that oath and live it, right? And how did I choose to change the world so that was more possible? I wrote poetry. And I actually thought, and this will strike you, Terry, as idiotic.
I actually thought that
writing poetry would be a means of changing the world because what I was reading was changing me so radically. Nothing in my life had as much power over me as what I read, both poetry and fiction. And when I began, too, I wanted to be a novelist as well as a poet. Then, of course, when I published my first book in an edition of 220, I said to myself, gee whiz, this is a big country for 220 books.
Would you feel that in some ways poetry is obsolete for a lot of people because they have movies and TV and songs to tell their stories?
Well, I'll tell you the truth. By this time, I didn't care, because by this time, I had fallen in love with the poem, and I loved writing it, and I didn't care. I mean, it was what I had to do, and whether it changes people or whether it doesn't, it's what I have to do.
Philip Levine, I want to thank you very much for talking with us.
Well, thank you, Terry. It's nice. It's a pleasure.
Poet Philip Levine. His latest collection of poems is called What Work Is. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Additional support comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
From Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. Northern Exposure won 6 Emmys this year. One of the most popular characters on the series is Holling Vincour, the owner of the town's tavern. Holling is played by John Cullum, who had a long career in Broadway musicals before relocating to television. Coming up, John Cullum talks and sings. Also, rock critic Ken Tucker plays a couple of his favorite summer hits. That's all coming up on Fresh Air.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Ann Taylor. Democratic presidential candidate Bill Clinton on this Labor Day traveled to Independence, Missouri, the hometown of President Harry S. Truman, to officially kick off the fall campaign. NPR's Mara Liasson reports.
Standing on the steps of the Jackson County Courthouse, Bill Clinton made a full-throated attack on George Bush and his presidency.
Harry Truman woke up every day dedicated to doing right for the people with whom he grew up and with whom he lived. The people who work hard, raise their kids, pay the taxes, and play by the rules. Harry Truman did not wake up every morning worrying about how to lower taxes one more time on millionaires.
George Bush has adopted Harry Truman and his 1948 campaign against a do-nothing Congress as a model. Today, Clinton's message was, "We knew Harry Truman and George Bush. You are no Harry Truman." In Kansas City, I'm Mara Liasson.
President Bush also campaigned in the Midwest today, where he defended his efforts to cast his campaign this year as similar to that of Democrat Harry Truman's effort back in 1948. While conceding that there were differences between the two candidates, Mr. Bush said that he too ran a small business, and like Truman, said he also admitted when he made a mistake. Campaigning in Michigan, Mr. Bush said his first aim is to build economic security for the working men and women of the nation, and he accused Bill Clinton of trying to scare voters into voting against the Republican ticket. Members of Congress are returning to Washington this week for a pre-election session scheduled to last 1 month. Lawmakers hope to finish work on a number of issues. NPR's Brian Naylor reports.
At the top of the agenda are the 13 appropriations bills needed to keep the government operating. So far, only one has passed, both the House and the Senate. While the appropriations measures are for the most part non-controversial, congressional Democrats plan to dare the president to veto a family leave bill and a measure to re-regulate cable TV. Congress is expected to give quick approval to a package of emergency aid to the victims of Hurricane Andrew, as well as okay a plan for long-term assistance to the nation's cities. That measure includes enterprise zones and some tax breaks, although not the capital gains tax cut the president wants. But everything the lawmakers do this month will be tinged with presidential election year politics. With Mr. Bush campaigning against some lawmakers by name in their districts and Democrats eager to do what they can to help Bill Clinton, it could make for a toxic atmosphere on Capitol Hill. This is Brian Naylor in Washington.
One-time presidential candidate Jesse Jackson has been named to head a voter registration drive by Democrats. In making the appointment, party chairman Ron Brown said the drive is aimed at people who have been shut out of the political process. This is NPR News. In South Africa, troops opened fire on an anti-government march and at least 24 people were killed. Nearly 200 people were wounded in the attack in Ciskei on a march sponsored by the African National Congress. This violence may block efforts to revive stalled talks between the ANC and the South African government on ending apartheid. The ANC has been trying to topple the government of Ciskei, one of several independent homelands set up by the South African government to create separate nations for blacks. Israeli Prime Minister Rabin says that Syria is not prepared to sign a peace treaty with Israel, even if Israel pulls out of the contested Golan Heights entirely. But the Israeli official says his country is willing to negotiate some arrangement, just short of a peace accord. NPR's Ted Clark reports.
In remarks transmitted by satellite to a B'nai B'rith conference in Washington, the Prime Minister noted that he has agreed to territorial compromise on the Golan Heights, but he insisted such compromise should lead to an Israeli-Syrian peace treaty, which he said Syria continues to oppose. However, Rabin said there is still something to negotiate about.
We are ready also, in the absence of readiness on the part of Syria, to negotiate peace treaty with us, even to negotiate interim arrangements.
Rabin offered no details about interim arrangements he may have in mind. Syrian negotiators continue to say, publicly at least, they will not accept interim arrangements with Israel. Rabin would have to offer something very attractive to break this impasse. This is Ted Clark in Washington.
Baseball Commissioner Faye Vincent has stepped down despite comments that he would never resign. Last week, baseball owners voted 18-9 in favor of a no-confidence measure that called on Vincent to quit. This is National Public Radio News in Washington.
This is Fresh Air. Perhaps the most offbeat town on television is Sicily, Alaska, where just about every resident is an eccentric. Sicily is the setting of the series Northern Exposure. Northern Exposure is actually filmed in Roslyn, Washington, just outside of Seattle. So earlier this year, when I was in Seattle for a public radio conference, I interviewed one of the most popular members of the cast, John Cullum. And since the series recently won 6 Emmys, we've decided to replay our interview. Cullum comes to television from a long career on Broadway in such musicals as Man of La Mancha, Camelot, and 1776. He originated the leading roles in On a Clear Day and Shenandoah. In Northern Exposure, Cullum plays Holling Vincour, a 63-year-old man whose lover is an 18-year-old beauty queen. Holling is the owner of the town's tavern. We recorded our interview at a popular Seattle tavern, the J&M Cafe, in front of an audience of public radio producers, program directors, and managers.
Thank you, Tara.
So, John, how was the character described to you when you first found out about Holling?
It was described to me as Gary Cooper meets Madonna. I said, I can live with that.
No, but here's the thing, let's get right to it. In a relationship where there's an older person with an 18-year-old,
right.
The terms that our society often uses is cradle snatcher, right? It's such a loving relationship. People really dig the relationship. So how is it talked over to make it just a kind of relationship everybody would relate to and feel really warmly about?
It's obvious that it's an outrageous relationship in the sense of the ages of the two people being different. But I never thought about that. I just thought, this is great for the old guy, you know. And if it's okay with her, it's okay with me. When we do the sex scenes, I've done sex scenes that I never thought I would ever do, and I wouldn't have done 10 years ago. But the first time I did any of those scenes, that was a circumcision scene.
Oh, yeah.
And it started off... with me, post-sex, it said in the script, she asks me a question about my virility, and I get a little upset. And then she looks down and says, you know, and I say, what's wrong? And she says, it's got a turtleneck. And I thought when I read this scene, I said, I could raise hell and say something about ridiculous, you know, I will only do this scene if it's necessary to the script and all that sort of stuff. But I thought, they'll never do this. It'll get cut.
No pun intended, right?
It gets cut. It got cut. And then I saw it on television, and there I was, and there she was looking down, and of course, all you could see was her looking down, and she said, looks like it's got a turtleneck, and I just about fell through the floor. I thought it was... But that was my first experience. After that, everything was kind of easy going.
So are there no, like, standards and practices, people reading the scripts every week and saying, you can't say that, you can't do that on TV?
I say it sometimes. They have a... they in a TV script, they have a tendency to write what I call opposing ideas. I mean, if like the old man with a young girl, and if I'm strong and virile, they will want me to cry. They've had those kind of contrary scenes, so and which I think that's fine. That's fast, quick. It gets the point across, and it's very good writing. But sometimes they have a tendency to write things that put me off a little bit.
Like and what?
Well, they had one scene where they wanted me to say that I love who I don't care anything about you, your mind. I only love you for your body. But this scene got me, it riled me because I didn't like the concept of the idea. And I thought, well, I will play this scene and I'll take the easy way out. I will paraphrase it. If I don't like it, I'll paraphrase it. And if they make an issue of it, I won't say it. I'll simply say, I won't do it. And what happened was, I got into the scene, and as I was playing it, it came out exactly as it was written. And instead of being something that was putting Shelley down, it turned out as a kind of a crude way of saying how much I really loved you. Because she was very concerned about me not caring for her physically. So it turned out to be a loving thing, and as long as it worked on that level, I got through that scene and it was okay.
My guest is John Cullum, who plays Holling Vincour on Northern Exposure. More after this short break. This is Fresh Air. We're listening to an interview I recorded in Seattle with John Cullum of Northern Exposure.
I want to hear something about your Broadway career. Now, you're a baritone, right?
Baritone.
So I think the only singing that you did before you got to Broadway was in the church choir.
That's right.
Yeah? So did you have the right kind of voice for projecting on a Broadway stage when you got to Broadway after singing
No.
in the church choir?
No, not really. But when I got to Broadway, I got into a production of Finian's Rainbow, playing Woody. It was a fluke, and an agent saw me, and he kept putting me up for musicals. And I was working doing Shakespeare in the Park for Joe Papp, and I was very comfortable in tights, much more comfortable in tights than in singing. I can tell you that, but. The audition was a disaster, but they asked me back, and I couldn't figure out why. But they asked me back a second time, and then they asked me, can you do something from Shakespeare? I said, I beg your pardon? I said, can you do something from Shakespeare? I said, I can do practically anything from Shakespeare, which was ridiculous. I had just done a couple of shows in Shakespeare, but I was also inebriated at the time. I hate to say this over public, anywhere, but the truth is, I was so nervous about singing that I finally started bolstering my confidence with liquor. And I was pretty blotched out when I sang the first time. And when I came back the second time, I was sober. But very, very nervous. Anyway, they asked me to do Shakespeare. I read some Shakespeare for them, and they needed a replacement they needed a standby for Richard Burton. And I got hired as the last person in the chorus to stand by for Richard Burton and for Roddy McDowell, and that's how I got into musical comedy.
Well, you were Richard Burton's standby in Camelot, right?
That's right.
So when you were understudying Richard Burton, did you pick up all of his mannerisms?
Oh, my God, yes. It took me 6 years to get over Richard. I can still get into trouble if I'm not careful. Oh, Allah has made a distant moon. Oh, yes, it was awful. But, to be, every review that I ever did, I was in his Hamlet too. I played Laertes in that. And then I did my own Hamlet afterwards in Milwaukee. And every reviewer was very impressed with my Burton-esque performance. To be or not to be. I found that I even twisted a pinky ring. And when I got nervous on stage, somebody said, "What are you doing? What does this mean?" And I said, "What does what mean?" And I was, Richard used to twist a pinky ring. And I even picked up physical mannerisms from him.
Now, you grew up in Knoxville, Tennessee.
Right.
You went into the Army in Korea for
That's
a couple
right.
of years, got out of the Army, and decided to get a master's degree in finance, worked in your father's real estate office. And
this
then,
is your life.
Yeah, right. And then you split for Broadway. You decided to just like leave and go to New York.
Yeah. I was leading three different lives in Knoxville, Tennessee. I was going to the university. I was working in my dad's office. And I was the kind of a fair-haired guy. I'd done a lot of Shakespeare. I'd done a lot of theater. And I was the tennis champion and the president of the fraternity and all this kind of stuff. And I was also the conductor of the Dixie Lee Junction Baptist Choir, which was a little choir way out. And I was picked up for drunken driving. It sounds like I was a real drunkard. Well, the truth is I drank a lot, and I don't drink anymore. But I was picked up for drunken driving, and it hit the papers. And if it hadn't been for that, I don't think I'd have had the courage to make the decision. I was 26. I had a nice business to take over, my dad's business. Obviously, I was unhappy. And I used that opportunity to break and go to New York.
So will we get to hear you sing on Northern Exposure, Sing More?
You mean, I did sing.
You sang Ave Maria.
Yeah.
Have they thought of trying to work in more of your singing into the show?
I don't know. It seemed like pulling hen's teeth then. You know, then I don't know whether I've ever told this story to anybody. It's a little embarrassing. But in the second or third episode, there was a section where Maurice took over the radio station, and he's playing Broadway show tunes that the astronauts went up into outer space with. And he names one Glenn liked to go up by Yule by the King and I, and another one, Kiss Me Kate. And this is the one, he says, that I went up in, and it was On a Clear Day You Can See Forever. And I looked at that thing and I thought, these guys don't realize it, that if they play the Broadway album, that's going to be me singing that song.
Wow.
And they didn't know that.
They really didn't know that?
No, they didn't know that.
Did you tell them?
I did, and they cut it. Yeah, I don't know whether they really realized it. Finally, they got around to asking me to do Ave Maria. And I was very nervous about that because they wanted me to do a cappella. And Ave Maria is an art song. It's not that easy to sing.
You know what I'd really love to do, and you could just tell me no. I'd love to ask you to sing a chorus of On a Clear Day.
Only for you, Terry. Can I do the introduction?
Oh, yeah.
You know, I don't even know whether I can know the words. Anyway, this is the scene where he's talking to Daisy Gamble, who has extrasensory perception. And he says, "Could anyone among us have an inkling or a clue what magic feats of wizardry and voodoo you can do? And who would ever guess what powers you possess? And who would have the sense to change his views and start to mind his ESPs and Qs? And who would ever dream of hearing phones before they ring, or ordering the earth to send you up a little spring, or finding you've been crowned the queen of lost and found? And who would not be stunned to see you prove there's more to us than surgeons can remove. So much more than we ever knew. So much more were we born to do. Should you draw back the curtain, this I am certain, you'll be impressed with you. On a clear day, rise and look around you, and you'll see who you are. On a clear day, how it will astound you that the glow of your being outshines every star. You'll feel part of every mountain, sea, and shore. You can hear from far and near a world you've never heard before. And on a clear day, I started in the wrong key. You realize that?
John Cullum plays Halling Vincour on Northern Exposure. We spoke in the spring at a tavern in Seattle during a public radio conference. Thanks to Kathy Ball, Art Ellis, and our friends at station KPLU. This is Fresh Air.
I'm Linda Wertheimer. Today on National Public Radio's All Things Considered, the campaign for the presidency officially kicks off with President Bush in Michigan and Governor Bill Clinton in Harry S. Truman's hometown of Independence, Missouri. Many people were killed today and many more wounded in a demonstration in the South African homeland of Ciskei when African National Congress demonstrators were fired upon by Ciskei troops. Also today, efforts in Florida to find family and friends not heard from since the hurricane, and a back-to-school saga of homework told in song and story. Also, jobs for entrepreneurial children better than a lemonade stand. That's all today on National Public Radio's All Things Considered.
For a lot of us, Labor Day means the end of summer. Rock critic Ken Tucker has some thoughts on two of this summer's best hit singles, on Vogue's version of Giving Him Something He Can Feel, and this one, Tom Cochran's Life is a Highway.
Sometimes you turn your back to the wind. There's a world outside the darkened door where blues won't haunt you anymore. With a brave heart, free lover's soul, come ride with me to the distant shore.
Of all the singles to hit the top 10 over the past few months, two songs jump out of the radio every time I hear them, and for very different reasons. Tom Cochran's Life is a Highway is a triumph of rock and roll cliches. A song that proves you can hammer together melodies, guitar licks, and verbal sentiments that have been around for 40 years now. And if you have some combination of talent, boldness, and naivete, you can still make those cliches come alive. As trite as it is, I don't see how anyone can resist this song's chorus. And indeed, millions haven't. So who's Tom Cochran? Well, as my younger brother said after he'd seen the Life is a Highway video on MTV, hey, have you gotten a load of your new favorite singer? He's a middle-aged fat guy who doesn't look anything like he sounds. My brother was terribly mean, if essentially accurate. Tom Cochran isn't just all of the above, he's also Canadian. For years up north, he led a band called Red Rider that was a big success everywhere but in this country, where its music, like a lot of Canadian pop culture, just sounded too ersatz American. This solo effort by Cochran was probably his last shot at a U.S. career, and it's really paid off. The other hit I'm obsessed with couldn't be more different. It's a new version of a 15-year-old Curtis Mayfield song by the vocal group En Vogue. Seen the movie Sparkle? It's a 1976 film about the rise and fall of a Motown girl group modeled on the Supremes. It's a terrific little movie, you can rent it on video, that starred actors who have since become better known, Irene Cara, Lynette McKee, and Dorian Harewood, who's now in the TV show I'll Fly Away. Curtis Mayfield wrote the score, a lovely pastiche of Motown-era music, and Aretha Franklin recorded the soundtrack album. I never understood why it wasn't a big hit, and evidently En Vogue didn't either, because their version of Giving Him Something He Can Feel virtually reproduces Franklin's arrangement of the song, capturing much of the original's gospel-tinged fervor. To me, this is the dreamiest hit of the year.
Ken Tucker writes about popular culture for Entertainment Weekly. Fresh Air's senior producer is Danny Miller. Our engineers this week are Richard Parker, Joyce Lieberman, Ron Barron, and Stephen Waterman. Thanks also to Ian Thistle. Roberta Sharrock directs the show. I'm Terry Gross.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting and by this and other NPR member stations. Additional support comes from the George Gund Foundation. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
On the next Fresh Air, as students get ready to go back to school, we talk about textbook censorship with Joan Delfatour, author of a new study on the subject. And we'll find out about the latest attempts to ban books from libraries. We'll talk with Judith Krug, the director of the American Library Association's Office for Intellectual Freedom. I'm Terry Gross. I hope you'll join us for the next Fresh Air.